Comment about Carl. I talked just a few minutes ago with his son Chris, and he did have a little mini stroke. His speech was slurred this morning at the end of services for just a few minutes, the doctors feel like that may be all that it was, just that little mini stroke. But they are doing further tests just to make sure that there maybe is not some further difficulty. But he was doing better, and feeling pretty good. And so I just want to make mention of that. Certainly, we need to keep him in our prayers. We'll give you more information as we get it. We talked this morning about the idea of restoration, especially as the book of Jude urges us to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. And we talked about how important it is for us to have that attitude of restoration, that restoration spirit. And I do have a concern that, like what happens to a lot of religious groups historically, who have had restorationism as the impetus for that group, sometimes that attitude can wane. And groups can evolve, and they lose that kind of restoration spirit. And I think that needs to be something that would concern all of us. And so I want to talk with you this evening as sort of a follow-up lesson to this morning about some things that I believe can destroy restoration. I guess that's working now. Things that destroy restoration, that can just be absolutely detrimental to what restoration is all about. And the first thing I want us to appreciate in all this is the problem of having an improper standard. When you're trying to be a restorationist, when you're recognizing that, okay, there is something that needs to be restored, you always have to have the proper standard. I don't care whether you're talking about Scripture or whether you're talking about restoring furniture or restoring an old car to its original condition, or whether you're talking about the people of Judah trying to restore their nation and their temple and those sacrifices, you always have to have a proper standard. Something that is the model, something that is the criterion by which you're judging yourself and then making those corrections as you see that the corrections need to be made. And a lot of people have an improper standard when it comes to this. Even people who may claim that they're trying to be restorationists. When you look at what Jude was talking about that faith once for all delivered, and he makes it very clear that it was a faith revealed by those apostles and prophets of Jesus Christ. In other words, those writings that we have from those apostles and prophets, what we conveniently call the New Testament scriptures, those are our access to that apostolic teaching. That has got to be the standard by which we then determine whether or not we are in accordance with God's revelation or not. And there is no other standard. Sometimes people have the idea that God is going to talk directly to them or communicate to them. And in fact, even in times past, there have been some movements in the name of restoration, that is claiming to be restoration type movements, that really have appealed to not the New Testament scriptures as the standard, but to some supposed modern day revelation or communication from God. I think one of the most well-known examples of that phenomenon is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its origin. A lot of people are not familiar with this, but when you go back and look at the origin of the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it arose in that early 19th century from the activity of Joseph Smith originally, and then after he died, Brigham Young, that Western branch of the movement. But this was a religious movement that arose in the heart of what we talked about this morning, the restoration movement in America. And in fact, it was influenced by that. In fact, you may not be aware, but Joseph Smith said that his religious movement was a restorationist movement. Now you say, how can that possibly be? Because Joseph Smith claimed to have received some latter-day revelation from God. And in fact, that latter-day revelation from God was the whole basis then for his supposed Book of Mormon that was this latter-day revelation. And yet what was claimed was that what Joseph Smith was translating as he looked into his hat and had the supposed words of those tablets from the angel Moroni revealed to him, this English translation, as he looked into his hat and then wrote that down. That was a story that he told. He said that Book of Mormon that he then wrote as a result of that process, that was really the original form of Christianity. And that the New Testament scriptures that we have, that they're a perversion and a corruption of what originally took place. That what we have here in our Bibles is not the original form of Christianity, but that God was now revealing it to him in this latter day so he could get back to the original. That was his concept. And that's the concept that he presented and that Brigham Young then carried on further, and that the Mormon Church adheres to this day, as its story of its origin. The whole concept there is that there is some latter-day revelation, but that's how we can supposedly know what the original first century church was and how we can restore it. Do you see how important it is to make sure when you're trying to be a restorationist that you have the proper standard? Because I'll tell you what, you cannot look at a better example, or maybe I should say a worse example, of how far people can depart, even in supposedly the name of restorationism, from what the New Testament scriptures really teach. No, the New Testament scriptures are not somehow corrupted, and we absolutely have an accurate knowledge of what those apostles and prophets were teaching in the first century. And that's very evident from all of the manuscripts that we have available to us. There's no question about that. There's no doubt about that. But it would absolutely be a mistake for anyone to think that he can restore the first century church, or to say it better, restore people to that teaching that the apostles were giving in the first century if he goes by any other standard but those New Testament writings. Because those New Testament writings absolutely are that proper standard. That's what the apostles wrote. That's what the apostles were teaching. And in fact, in passages such as Galatians chapter 1 and verse 8, we there read the apostle Paul talking about that if any man or even an angel from heaven, whether his name is Moroni or whatever other name someone might want to use, if even an angel from heaven should teach some doctrine contrary to that which you had received, Paul said, let him be accursed. So the whole concept of restoration is destroyed if we don't have the proper standard. And the proper standard, the apostles of Jesus said, it's their teaching, it's their writings. And that's what we have here in the New Testament books. I think something else that is absolutely destructive to a restoration mindset, it's this. Focusing on the mistakes that other restorationists have made in times past. I tell you, this is a problem that a lot of people have that just causes them to just deny the need or even the possibility for any kind of restoration. As we talked about this morning, there's a lot of people throughout history who have initiated restoration efforts, whether you're talking about Martin Luther or John Calvin, and you can look at these men and what their doctrines produced, and there are some good things that they said, some very accurate things that they said, and yet you can look back at that historically and compare it with what the New Testament says, and there's just a lot of errors in the thinking of Luther and John Calvin. A lot of areas where they did not completely restore, where they didn't get back to what the New Testament actually said. And that's not peculiar to them. You can look at the Puritans that we mentioned this morning. You can look at the Amish, and you can see things that really don't square with what the New Testament says. And yet there are some laudable things that these groups have advocated in their attempt to restore. But there also are some things that I think probably most of us would look at that and we would say, well, they made some mistakes. They didn't go all the way back in every aspect to what the New Testament said. Or they misunderstood or misconstrued some things. And that happens in about any restoration movement that you want to look at, or any example of people that you want to study historically who tried to be restorationists and go back to what the Bible says, there's always going to be some good things that you'll say that they were doing, and then other things where you kind of scratch your head and you go, well, I wonder why they practiced that, or why didn't they see this? And that's true even when you look at the American Restoration Movement that hits closer home with us. I mean, when you look at the writings and the practices of these early restorationists of the 18th and 19th centuries, and from their teachings, groups produced that would refer themselves as disciples of Christ, the Christian church, or churches of Christ. When you look at their teachings, there's a lot of good things that they teach. In fact, as I look at what I believe the Bible says from my study, I would certainly feel closer to men like Barton W. Stone or Alexander Campbell than say I would some in the Amish movement. But nevertheless, there's a lot of things about their teaching and their practices where I kind of scratch my head and I say, I don't understand why they didn't see this. But sometimes they didn't. And you have to understand that they're human beings and they're frail just like I am, just like all of us are, and we're all fallible. And when you look at past restoration attempts, what you see is that other restorationists have sometimes made mistakes. Here's the conclusion that a lot of people in our day draw, therefore. Restorationism doesn't work. What's the point then? All these restoration movements, they didn't really get all the way back to what the Bible said. They made tons of mistakes as we look at that now. So a lot of people in our day say, so there's no need for us to even try. There's no reason for us to even try. It's an impossible task. There's a lot of people who are teaching that today. There's a lot of people who are teaching that today in churches that would identify themselves as churches of Christ. A lot of people who teach that. It's that attitude of indifference I talked about this morning. Sometimes it springs from a group of people who really have lost a restoration spirit and become just preservationists of their own tradition, and then people react to that and then see mistakes that others have made of a similar nature, and they say, well, restoration doesn't work, and so we just don't even need to try. That's a mistake in thinking. And focusing on the mistakes of other restorationists who have not done things right in our judgment, that's going to rob us of a restoration spirit if we let it. Let me just tell you something. You can point your finger at other people who have failed in their restoration attempts in this area or in that one, or they've made mistakes here and there. And probably 100 years from now, it may be that people look back and they say, you know, the Valrico Church of Christ, there's some things they were doing. I don't know why they did that. Maybe we're mistaken in something that we are not aware of. Maybe we haven't gotten all the way back to what the Scriptures say. We think we have, but maybe we've missed something. But even if that's the case, the desire to restore ourselves to the teaching of the apostles of Jesus Christ, and that's our standard, and that's what we're striving for, even if we err from time to time, that's the right goal. And nothing's ever going to change that. And the fact that Martin Luther made mistakes, the fact that Alexander Campbell made mistakes, the fact that the Valrico Church of Christ might be making some mistake, that doesn't change the proper goal that we have and the rightness of that goal. Because God calls upon us to abide by His teaching. And the fact that we can point to our fallibilities as human beings, where we've made mistakes here and there, all that proves is that we're human and humans err. It doesn't change what God said our goal needs to be, what we're striving for. It ought to make us more ready to critique ourselves. It ought to make us more humble and not just think that because, well, we claim to be restorationists, then we must have succeeded in all areas. Others have thought the same thing. And we can look at them and see some mistakes that they have made. So it ought to make us humble. But the goal of trying to make sure that we're in accordance with the teaching of the apostles and prophets, that's the right goal. That's what we need to be striving for. And so focusing upon mistakes that other restorationists have made, if we're not careful, that can destroy restoration spirit. What we need to recognize is other people have made mistakes, but we're going to try our best to be what God wants us to be. Now that leads me to this other point here, things that destroy restoration. I think this is a major problem that we have that we need to give some attention to. Trying to determine other people's destiny. Trying to determine other people's destiny. If that's where you focus your attention, it's in all likelihood going to hinder your restoration effort. May even destroy it. I'll tell you why. You know, there is something in us as human beings that causes us to want to be able to look at other people that we respect, that we know, especially those that we care about, and we want to be able to say, well, I know that they're going to heaven. We want to be able to say about all these people what their eternal destiny is. And I suppose that's maybe human nature to want to know all that. Here's what a lot of people do, though. And I see this all the time. There are people that maybe we care about them very deeply, and yet their lives are not in accordance with what we see the Bible teaches, what seems to us to be what the Bible clearly teaches, and yet we care about these people, and maybe others that we respect, and again, we see mistakes in their beliefs or in their practices, and yet we want to be able to say that those people are absolutely right with God and their eternal destiny is fine and good. We want that to be the case. And here's what then can happen. You then start out with your religious worldview is to find some way to make sure that whatever conclusions you come to about the truth, it doesn't exclude so-and-so. I don't want to hold any doctrines or any views that would be implicitly saying that, well, so-and-so or that group they're with, they're wrong. And so what happens then? Our standard kind of shifts. Instead of God's truth being our standard, instead our standard has kind of become, well, whatever I can interpret this or however I can interpret it to make sure that the umbrella includes all these other people out here that I want to make sure are in. You see what I'm talking about? That kind of attitude, that kind of focus, trying to determine other people's destiny and all that, that's not our prerogative. You know what James said in James chapter 4, verse 12? He said, there's only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? In the whole context, James is talking about this human tendency to want to condemn other people or to pronounce them saved. And James says, that's God's job. That's His prerogative. That's not our responsibility. And we don't have a right to ultimately say whether anybody else is going to heaven or hell. That's not our responsibility. What our job is to look into the writings of the apostles and prophets and to the best of our ability interpret them properly and preach that to other people so other people can know the truth and so we ourselves can be practicing what that truth is. But our job and our prerogative is not to declare this group is right or that person is going to heaven and he's fine and all that. That's God's job. And the fact of the matter is, I hope, and I think we have reason to believe from what the scriptures teach, that God is a merciful God, and those people who are striving to serve Him, and He knows their true hearts, I have hope that God is going to be gracious. And I have reason to hope that, about God being gracious to the mistakes and the failings of a lot of people who have striven to serve Him and maybe have not come up to the proper standard. I hope that because of my own failings. Because I recognize that even though, like Paul said, I have nothing against myself that I'm aware of, that doesn't make me justified. God's the judge, not me. And the fact that we in this congregation, we believe we're doing what is right, but maybe we've missed something, I would absolutely hope that God will be merciful, and I think we have reason to be merciful, but here's the point. Even if God is merciful, that doesn't change what the truth is. Even if those people that we're so concerned about, our loved ones or the people that we respect that we so desperately don't want to have to condemn in some way, even if God does show them mercy on Judgment Day, despite the fact that they were not practicing totally what His Word said, that wouldn't change the fact that His Word said that. And that's what His Word teaches. And in fact, how, in effect, rebellious it would be of us to knowingly not abide by what His Word teaches just because we don't want by our words or our practices to be condemning this person or that group. For us to knowingly compromise truth because we're trying to find a way to include so-and-so that we care about so much and not condemn them. That's really an attitude of rebellion. That's God's right, not our right. And so we need to appreciate this, and we need to see the problem here that comes about when people try to determine other people's destiny. And I've recently had discussions with some people that I fear are losing this whole concept of restoration and the real need to make sure that you're really going by the Scriptures and to have that kind of ardent desire to correct any and all mistakes. I'm worried that part of what seems to me maybe to be indicating that they're losing that kind of spirit is that there's certain people that they have a lot of respect for. They're good people. And I just can't see God condemning them, and so I want to make sure I include them. And so that causes people to then just say, well, you know, maybe we're making too big a deal about this biblical teaching or that biblical teaching, and, you know, maybe we shouldn't stress all that as much because we don't want to condemn so-and-so because they're really good people, and you see what happens? No, trying to determine the other people's destiny out there, that's not our job. That is something that will destroy restorationism because that's not the basis upon which you determine what truth is. You determine what truth is on the basis of what were these apostles and prophets teaching in the first century, whether that is contrary to my practice or the practice of whoever that I respect and love, so be it. But what were the apostles teaching in the first century? That's our standard. That's what we're trying to get back to. That's what we're trying to restore. Things that destroy this attitude of restoration. Here's a huge one. An attitude of satisfaction. An attitude that, we've already restored things sufficiently. Yeah. It's sort of a mission accomplished attitude. And I really worry about that among, quote, us, because frankly, as we've even talked about this morning, all restoration movements that you can look at historically that I know about, they've kind of reached a point where they've restored certain things, and so the group is doing those things, and those things identify that group in distinction from maybe other people, and so those become their key doctrines, and they become preservationists, not restorationists then. They become satisfied. And there's sort of an attitude that even says, well, we're the group who's trying to really restore things and get back to the Bible, and so we've done that, and so if somebody is not in accordance with our beliefs and practices, well, that must mean they're not in the right group, because we're the group that's trying to restore things, and that we have restored things, and so we kind of suddenly shift the standard to this kind of partyistic spirit where our group, who's historically emphasized these teachings, well, we're the right group, and so how do we know that we're the right group? Well, because we're the group that is restorationist, right? And so we just kind of lose sight of this, and it all then results in sort of a satisfied attitude. Yeah. We've restored various teachings, and we've shown where this group over there is in error in what they're practicing about baptism, and this group is in error about the Lord's Supper, and this group is in error on this. And I think, yeah, all those things that we're pointing out are accurate, but then what happens is we just become satisfied. Well, okay, good job, great, all right. And I even hear preachers. In fact, I read an article a few years ago by a well-respected preacher, and maybe he meant something else, and maybe he just misspoke. I hope so. But the point of his article was, well, we've already restored at least all the important things in churches of Christ. We've already restored those things. So people ought to be able to see that. It's just a loss of that whole restoration spirit. Let me point out this passage to you. Passage in 2 Chronicles, talking about the restoration effort of Asa. I mentioned him this morning. King Asa of Judah. Talks about several things that Asa did, but then here's, as the text comes down to verse 16, it says, "And Asa also removed Maacah, the mother of King Asa, from the position of queen mother, because she had made a horrid image as an Asherah, and Asa cut down her horrid image, crushed it, and burned it at the brook Kidron." Just a lot of things that Asa did to try to correct things and to bring the people's practice back into accordance with what the law of Moses said. But look at verse 17. "But the high places were not removed from Israel." But the high places were not removed from Israel. Do you know what the high places are? The high places, that was just a term for those cultic centers that the Canaanites would build on, as one of the prophets said, on every high hill. You know, just some area where they could put up a offering, and so it was a high place. It was a place for a offering to the various gods. And sometimes those high places were used by the Israelites to offer a sacrifice to Yahweh. But the law of Moses said that the sacrifices to Yahweh from the nation, they were all to be brought to that central sanctuary that ultimately was set up in Jerusalem. And that was the spot where Yahweh's name was, and that's where he was to be sacrificed to. And the high places weren't to be used. They were to be destroyed. And yet, what is pointed out here, even though Asa did so many good things, there was something that was overlooked. And I think the text is implying it wasn't that it was purposely overlooked, but as we've already seen with any restoration movement, well, sometimes they missed something. Or maybe they started to, but it wasn't fully accomplished. And so, the author of Chronicles points out, the high places, for whatever reason, they weren't removed. Now he points out, "Nevertheless, Asa's heart was blameless all his days. His heart, his attitude was right with God. God was pleased with it, with his heart. But here was a mistake that was made. Here was something that was overlooked. Here was something that was out of accordance with the law of Moses, and it went uncorrected. Now later, as you keep going in Old Testament history, the high places were ultimately destroyed. But not here. Not by Asa, not during his reign, not in his restoration attempts. Now let me ask you a question. What if the people after Asa did, what if they just said, you know what? Asa did a great job. In fact, we've done a great job of restoring things. Let's pat ourselves on the back and all the things that we have corrected, all the idols that we've removed, all the things we've done to get back to the law of Moses. You know what would have happened if they had been content with that kind of attitude of satisfaction, that kind of mission accomplished attitude, where restoration is no longer needed because we've done everything? They would never have corrected the problem with the high places that got overlooked in Asa's reign. And so this kind of satisfaction attitude, it just snuffs out a restoration spirit. It just destroys it. Because it says in great arrogance and pomposity, we, our party, our group, we've accomplished the goal now. So now we don't have to worry about it anymore. Just everybody do what our group has now established, and it'll all be fine. And in effect, what that means is you don't need to have the attitude of restoration. Just preserve what we've done so far, and you'll be fine. No. That's not the attitude of God's people. That's not what God wants our attitude to be. And that is the exact opposite of a restoration spirit. So we need to make sure that we have open minds. We need to make sure that no matter what it is, and we say this sometimes, I think sometimes it becomes just a traditional little statement that we make, but we want anyone, if anyone sees anything we're doing that's wrong here, you'd be our friend if you point that out to us, and we'll, you know. Okay, well, we need to really mean that. I hope that we do. And I hope that we're open-minded and that we don't just look at passages as proof texts to establish the doctrines we already have concluded are such and such. We need to always read passages with the attitude of, okay, what was the author saying to his original readers? Get the context. What was he really saying? And always be willing to go back and reassess and reevaluate. That's the attitude of a true disciple. That's the attitude of a true restoration spirit. And so we need to not just have some attitude of satisfaction. Things that destroy restorationism. Let me mention real quickly one final point. Ignoring what Jesus referred to as the weightier matters of the law. Ignoring the weightier matters can absolutely destroy this whole restoration attempt. Let me explain to you what I mean. Do you recall the passage I'm alluding to? Matthew 23, verse 23. This is Jesus in the context of his harsh denunciation of the Pharisees, who were the religious leaders of the Jews of his day. And Jesus railed against them throughout his ministry, culminating with this point in the final week of his ministry, where he condemns them over and over again as hypocrites. They weren't hypocrites in the sense of some guy who gets in a pulpit on Sunday and praises God and all that, but then purposely goes out and has an affair, you know, during the week. Not a hypocrite in that sense. But Jesus says they were hypocrites because they were presenting to people an air of that they were righteous. And yet in reality, Jesus says, you've overlooked the weightier matters of the law. He says in verse 23, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others. You know, here's a problem that the Pharisees had that, frankly, restorationist-minded people can easily slip into. There are things that are weightier about certain teachings of God, weightier than other things in His teaching. That's not to suggest there are things, and Jesus isn't suggesting, that there are things in God's revelation that He commands us to do that we can, well, here are the important things to obey, but other things that are not as weighty, well, you can ignore them. No, Jesus says, no, these things you should have done without neglecting the others. But there are some principles that are weightier, that have a greater priority because of their foundational nature. Jesus lists some here, some examples. Things like justice and mercy and faithfulness. When you put this statement of Jesus in the context of all of His discussions with the Pharisees, He was constantly talking with them about how you focus so much attention upon all these things that are technical obediences to God, but you've neglected, Jesus said, the second greatest commandment, which is to love your neighbor. And all these things, justice and mercy and faithfulness, relate to your relationship with other people. And those are things that God even views as more important than even the proper sacrifices to be offered, Jesus said to the Pharisees. Yes, God wants the proper sacrifices. Yes, He wants you to obey when you tithe mint and dill and cumin. Yeah, you should do that, but not to ignore then the weightier matters. Now, why do you think weightier matters like these, things that relate to your relationship with other people and how you treat other people, why would those have been things that the Pharisees might have neglected? Well, I'll tell you one reason. Because they're a lot harder to fulfill. They're a lot harder to fulfill. Oh yeah, to pluck off a little tenth of your plant to then give as a tithe to the temple, well, you can do that pretty easy. Doesn't require a whole lot. But getting along with my next door neighbor that just burns the fire out of me and I can't stand, but boy, I've got to be nice to him. Now that's tough. Making sure that I'm treating my spouse in a proper way, sometimes that can be tough. Unfortunately, she feels the same way about you. Those things are harder. They're weightier, they're more important, but they're harder. And also, those things aren't as visible. You know, when you go up to the temple and you worship in public and you offer the sacrifice or you give your tithe, everybody sees you. When you pray on the street corner like the Pharisees would do, everybody sees you and everybody says, well, what a godly person that is. But if your heart is not what it should be, they don't see that. If you're not treating somebody the way you should, with mercy and justice and faithfulness the way you should, people won't see that. It's not as public. It's not out there like all the other kind of worship acts of God. And so those are things, the weightier matters, Jesus said, you've neglected those. And so here are people who were neglecting the weightier matters, and yet they thought that God's pleased with me. We're restorationists. We've restored all these things. And Jesus says, but the weightier matters you've neglected. And those are the harder things. And they're the more easily ignored because they're not as visible. Because so much of it is attitudinal, and it's not overt and out in the public where everybody would necessarily see. And so what Jesus is trying to say is that you dare not ignore these weightier matters. And I'll tell you what happens. And I think it happens a lot of times among churches of Christ, where we focus our attention upon baptism and we focus our attention upon the Lord's Supper every Sunday and we focus our attention upon the proper organization and the proper worship and all those things. And that needs to be focused upon. That needs to be addressed. Absolutely. But if we're not careful, we'll be just like the Pharisees, and these weightier matters of how you treat other people and how you act toward other people, if you're not careful, you'll ignore those things and yet think that you're just a real fine restorationist. Jesus says, now those are the weightier matters that are most important. And in fact, if you'll give attention to all those things, well then of course the other things, yes, you would not neglect. And you shouldn't, Jesus says. But you've sure got to give attention to these things. Or at the end of the day, Jesus says, no matter how many mince and cumin you tithe, you will not have really been pleasing to God. You'll not have really restored yourself to what God's teaching really is. Not if you neglect these weightier matters. So we're talking this evening about several things that can destroy restoration. And again, the reason why I've been emphasizing these things in these two lessons is because I think in our day and time, at this point, maybe in history, this tends to be one of those things that I think, quote, we really need. We really need to give attention to this whole business of whether or not we are losing a restoration spirit and what that restoration spirit is all about. And we sure better be careful about these things that can destroy it. Thank you for listening to me. I hope these things have been challenging to you. I hope that they're helpful to you and to me and to all of us, and that we can discuss them further. If there is someone here tonight who needs to make his or her life right with God, we sure would love to help you do that. Won't you let that be known while together we stand and sing this song of encouragement?